I haven't done that experiment because the liquid nitrogen might not be a bipolar molecule. I think it is not. As such, the liquid nitrogen might be a thorough non-absorber of microwaves. As such, when you're doing that test, I recommend you put the cup of liquid nitrogen in there alongside of a cup of water. Because liquid nitrogen strikes me as, I think it's called N2. I think that's the molecule. I think it's a non-polar molecule, non-bipolar molecule. Therefore, it might be a non-absorber. Therefore, if you did the experiment with those two cups in there simultaneously, I think there's a high probability the cup of water will get hot and the liquid nitrogen will do nothing. There's a slim chance that that would be the answer, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
There was a famous Dick quote, "Give the man a cigar." You got the right answer. Nitrogen 2, N2. It's two atoms of nitrogen. Second one, the most, the strongest bond. And LN2, which is liquid nitrogen, is actually in liquid form, but it's non-polarized. So the temperature would not change. The microwave will go through it, not seeing that it exists, as the water will warm up. Back to you, N2XJN.
So according to Wes, I won us a car on that one. I made a guess, and it looks like I hit it right. And so, interesting science experiment. Mr. M-H-Y, give me your full call. I should know you and your name, and go right ahead with your question on this one.
Yeah, K2IRW, KC2MHY. You know, listen, I heard you talking about the eyes and everything, and something just struck my attention, because I had a corneal transplant not too long ago, right? And now I got to go for a cataract in my right eye. I do use an HT, right? And I know when I taking the test there for the technician, they did say RF exposure. HTs you have to be very careful with, right? Do you believe that that could be a problem that I'm having if I'm spending hours talking on the HT to where it does have exposure, you know, to my eye and everything? So, my right eye, I have to get a cataract surgery in January, and then in my left eye, there's a small cataract. They definitely performing, so they definitely watching for that. You think it's a problem with the HT of basically operating many hours? Because I know if, you know, they say to have the antenna away from your head, usually you have to have it on a slant. You think that might be cause of the problem? K2IRW, KC2MHY.
Kevin, I'm not K2IRW, I'm K2RIW, Romeo, India, Whiskey, minor difference. Slim chance, but yes. The Radio Society of Great Britain, in their great big three-volume manual on radio techniques, I can't remember the name of the thing, I think it's the second volume, has a whole bunch of chapters on the subject of radio frequency biohazard. And the RSGB recommends that you hold your handy-talkie sideways, not hold it vertically, so that the rubber duck is further away from your eye. If you're running a 5-watt handy-talkie, particularly on 450, where the rubber duck is a lot smaller, and therefore, depending on how you hold it, the rubber duck could be relatively close to your forehead. And if you're doing relatively long transmissions, approaching 6 minutes at a time, key down while you're doing a long-winded conversation on a simplex frequency with somebody. Let me drop. Under those conditions, there is a possibility of your handy-talkie giving you some excess heating of the cornea of your eye and possibly creating accelerating the rate at which your particular genetics of your family develops a cataract. There is that possibility. But in order to really get into the realm where that would do it, you'd have to operate with fairly long transmissions. The way a guy usually uses a handy-talkie, he transmits for 30 seconds and listens for 30 seconds and so on, and sometimes longer, because there's a six-minute time constant of the human eye. You've got to work at it. If you make key-down transmissions for 6 minutes with the thing vertical, hold with the rubber duck close to your forehead, yes, you are under those conditions going beyond the threshold of maximum permitted exposure. So there's a chance that that was an aggravating factor. By the same token, a handy-talkie used for long periods of time, depending on the brand name, let me drop. The case of the thing gets thermally quite hot in your hand. To have that hot object close to your body could be a second source of energy into your eye that could be giving your eye some grief. So was it the handy-talkie getting hot, the RF coming out of the rubber duck being close, the combination of the two, and long transmissions with your eye open, staring into the rubber duck, key down for 6 minutes? You do that combination, and without a doubt, you're pushing your luck from my point of view, Kevin. KC2MHY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thanks a lot, dear Dick. And my next question, I'm about to ask you, that they was talking about cell phones there, too. That cell phones, if you got it very close to your ear, sometimes that could cause a problem also. I think they said some people might suffer a little brain damage. I'm not really a big candidate for really talking on cell phones for a long period of time either. Does that really have effect also there? Go ahead.
In the case of a cell phone, it is my opinion, Kevin, that you're a hell of a lot safer. A cell phone rarely goes beyond 0.3 watt, and even then, only when you're at the maximum range. A cell phone is a power-managed system. Depending on how close you are to the cell site, it readjusts its power accordingly. If you're real close to the cell site, that thing can go down to 1 milliwatt of output, because that's all it needs. It continuously adjusts itself just so that it has enough signal-to-noise ratio at the cell site. It does that for two reasons. One, to save battery power, and two, the cell company would like to reuse that frequency a couple of cells away. And if they could force you into using lower power, the whole system becomes happier. So if you're at maximum range from the cell site, where you're getting very few bars, so to speak, yes, your cell phone can run as high as about 0.3 watt. The 0.3 watt. Nowadays, they put the antenna down near the microphone at the bottom of the cell phone where it's heating up your chin instead of heating up your ear. The reason they did that is not to make it safer as far as biohazard is concerned. Let me drop. They did that because some people wear a hearing aid. And the RF energy at a pulse nature coming out of the cell phone going into the hearing aid could give you some funny sounds in the hearing aid. So in order to have the hearing aid work correctly, they put the antenna as far away from the ear as you can get. Now, when it comes to cell phone radiation into a human head, does that create cancer? There's been lots of studies looking for that. Over all of these years, they haven't found it. Of all the studies that I know of cell phone exposure to a human being, first of all, each individual cell phone, you go to the right website, you look up your brand of cell phone and your model of cell phone, and it has a specifically measured quantity called SAR, specific absorption rate. The absorption rate of each brand of cell phone has been rated, so you can find out what the rating is. And what that cell phone, what that specific absorption rate is, it's rated in watts per kilogram of human tissue. And so a small amount of heating does take place of the local tissue of your body, whichever part is closest to the antenna. Back in the days when the antenna was closest to the earphone, they did do an experiment. The experiment they did is they have a bunch of volunteers using cell phones. Some of the cell phones are active and some of them are inactive, and it was a double-blind test. The people using the cell phone did not know which was which. And they did the experiment and had people, while using the cell phone, do mental mathematics. That was the test. and the people with the active cell phone could do mental mathematics a little bit faster than the people who had the inactive cell phone. Let me drop. The reason for that is back in the days when the antenna was close to the ear and the cell phone was heating up the local brain material right behind the ear. I don't know the exact number, but maybe the brain material was being heated by an extra half a degree Fahrenheit. It turns out when you heat your brain material an extra half a degree Fahrenheit, your brain can do calculating a little bit faster. Those people did faster, more accurate calculation of mental mathematics. To my knowledge, that is the only confirmable, measurable experiment that shows that a cell phone does something that you can measure as a change to a human being. There are loads and loads of people who are positive that their particular glioblastoma brain tumor was created by a cell phone. And they'd love to use anecdotal evidence. Well, my brain tumor is on the right-hand side of my head. I always held the cell phone on the right-hand side. Aha, that's it. By the same token, the people in the town of Bayville are absolutely positive. The majority of them are positive that the cell phone site that's existing on top of the water tower in Bayville, it's the highest object they've got in the town, which gives them the antennas for their fire, police, ambulance, and cell site. Those antennas, that water tower happens to be across the street from the school, 200 feet away, a long distance. Low power signals coming out of those things. No danger at all because of the inverse square law. But because a child in the school developed leukemia, because a teacher in the school developed cancer, the people in the town are saying, aha, that's it. We want all of the antennas removed from this town and put in some other town. They've been in that mode of operation for the last 3 years. You can go to their website called BRAC, B-R-A-C, Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers, B-R-A-C-T. In other words, the majority of the residents of the town have been talked to by some fairly charismatic person who wants all the antennas removed from that town. It's an unreasonable request. And there are specific FCC rules saying you cannot do that. The Communication Act of 1996, loosely defined, essentially says... It essentially says you cannot deny the sighting of a cell site because of a perceived risk of radio frequency biohazard. Town after town after town for tremendous amounts of money was being spent in the past arguing about whether or not the cell site is creating danger to human beings. Absolutely not. The FCC finally came to the conclusion this is a huge waste of money. They wrote a rule saying you can't do that. You study the specifics of a cell site versus a cell phone. Because a cell site consists of an antenna that might be 100 or 150 feet high, it's probably a quarter of a million pounds of equipment, half a million dollars worth of stuff. You look at it, it's a great big, in some people's mind, ugly structure. It looks dangerous as all hell. And you take this innocent-looking fraction of a pound cell phone in your hand, and you compare the difference between the two. Because the cell phone is a quarter of an inch away from your head, and you apply the mathematics of inverse square law, quarter of an inch of distance versus 200 feet. If you bought the house directly next door to the cell site, you couldn't get any closer than 200 feet to that antenna. And the antenna is way above you, squirting the signal out to the horizon. You compare the real energy coming out of the cell site during drive time, when everybody's calling home saying, should I pick up a loaf of bread? When the cell site is most busy, and you compare that to your cell phone against your head, the difference is more than a million to one. The cell phone against your head, I didn't say it's unsafe, but it's giving you an amount of RF energy into your body 1 million times stronger than if you lived directly next door to that cell phone site, the cell site. It doesn't make good common sense. Let me drop. You say those words in front of a zoning board of your town, and the majority of the people in the zoning board will say, what planet are you on? Because they're positive that a great big chunk of hardware got to be dangerous. It's squirting out microwaves. And by the way, microwaves are 5 to 1 safer than VHF, UHF. So they're misunderstanding on multiple levels. The cell phone against your head is more than a million times stronger in specific absorption rate to your body. I didn't say it's unsafe, but if you want to worry about something that's unsafe, worry about the thing that's close to you, the thing that's 200 feet away. Unless it was radiating an amount of power equivalent to a broadcast station, tens of kilowatts, and it doesn't do that. At the maximum power during drive time is around 35 watts. The school that Bayville people are trying to protect their students against those antennas, the amount of heating that's created by the RF energy out of those antennas is equivalent to a 35-watt incandescent light bulb. If you're protecting yourself from a cell site, you're protecting yourself of the heat that's generated by a 35-watt incandescent light bulb. Do you have to be 200 feet away from that to get protection? As you can see, there's a whole lot of levels of misunderstanding on this one. I guess that was Kevin. I know this is not the whole story, but maybe it helps a little bit. KC2MHY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WHY, I want to comment on this subject.
Okay, thank you very much, dear Dick. I appreciate it. And you got another caller in there. Thanks a lot for your explanation. And it makes me feel real comfortable the way you put everything into perspective. So you got it back, Dick, and I'll take a standby. Got another caller in there, KC2MHY.
Okay, very fine, Kevin. Joe, W2RYY. Go ahead and correct me on this. You got a joke, K2RIW.
I'm not going to correct you like you're correcting the professor. But you know what I mean. I think some of the older phones on the higher frequency band and the PCS band, which is like the 1950 megahertz band approximately, do run a little more power, because I believe this cell phone I use, which is older, but it's a GSM platform phone, can go as high as 1 watt. But that's only pulsed energy coming out of the thing. It's not a continuous carrier. And here's an interesting thing I did notice about the phone. When it's connected with the cell site making a call, it does not put out energy on the uplink frequency all the time. It only puts it out periodically to keep a handshake with the system. When you talk, then it puts out more energy. So if you're sitting there doing more listening than talking on the phone in a conversation, it's not putting out very much energy while it's in a... while you're listening, and it's not transmitting your voice on the uplink frequency. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that point, Rich. Joe, when it comes to RF heating, you have to integrate for 6 minutes. Lots and lots of people will study a radar, a cell phone, or whatever, which is putting out pulsed energy, and the pulsed energy might be a nice high number during the pulse. But in many of these systems, the pulses have what's called a certain duty factor. The pulse is on for a certain percentage of the time. In the case of a high-power, long-range radar, the pulse is on the air either 1% of the time or 0.1% of the time. Therefore, if it was 0.1% of the time, the average power is 1,000 times lower than the peak power. The peak power, as far as thermal heating of human tissue is concerned, almost doesn't matter. It's the average power that creates the heating. And that the 60 years of study of the American National Standards Institute, represented in that C95 report, 60 years of study of your best laboratories, institutions, and whatever, your smart people. And by the way, that document has got over 500 references in the back of it of all of the years of all of these studies. They have never found anything confirmable other than the thermal effect. Radio energy hitting your body gets converted into heat. That's the only effect that you can really measure, including the increase in brain power of doing mental mathematics, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So when you want to evaluate radio frequency biohazard, you have to calculate the average power to do it, not peak power. Lots of people make that mistake. In the case of a radar, the radar is putting out very brief pulses. The average power is 100 or 1,000 times lower than the peak power. The antenna itself is usually a pencil beam aimed in some particular direction, and the antenna usually rotates. So you're standing out there in front of the antenna, and the antenna swishes by and rotates once every 12 seconds. And so for about a second, it's aimed at you, putting out these brief pulses. Under real operating conditions, you calculate the amount of danger of a high-power radar, even though it's a great big, heavy, expensive-looking piece of microwave equipment. It looks dangerous as all hell. It goes to the specifics, and you'll see that it's a hell of a lot safer than first meets the eye. Pun intended. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, which I think we're eventually going to begin the mailbag, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Dick, it's almost 10:30. You think we should save the question for next week and let Paul get on with his report?
Well, let's do a compromise. Let's go over to Paul to give us the National Aeronautics and Space Administration report. Then with the time left over, for people who can stay up late, there is a little bit of a lecture that's going to take place. For those who can't stay up this late, since the mic number one site records everything, in other words, you go to www.amateurradio.tv, you can play back the recording 5 days from now. So if you can't stay up this late because you got to go to work tomorrow morning, you will be able to hear the lecture by going there. So let's go over to Paul, and then we'll flip back to that so-called lecture of that beautiful question that Kay asked us. So Paul, WS2N, what's the latest on 67P, the comet, and Rosetta? And I think there's almost no action of Philly, the lander, coming back to life yet. But we've got some hopes that it's going to in the future, don't we, Paul? WS2N with the space report. K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is WS2N. Yes, Dick, I did hear that could be possible, so we'll keep our fingers crossed. But a couple of months from now, maybe it'll get more light. Double tasking here, multitasking, listening to the net, and just finished also watching on NASA TV the docking of a Soyuz spacecraft to the International Space Station. It just took a 6-hour ride up to it. I saw the launch around 4 o'clock, 4:01 this afternoon from Baikonur in Kazakhstan. So it worked out quite well. So if any young people are watching, they had Olaf, the snowman, attached to a string, and they hang it above the cosmonaut's head and by the control panel. And it actually has a job. It lets them know when they're in orbit. It starts floating, so which was pretty cool. You get to see video live, they show you the inside of the spacecraft as they're going uphill. We drop it.
Now, let me ask you a question on this one, Paul. I believe they've initiated a brand new protocol. In other words, the sequence they used to go through to launch, get the orbits co-elliptic, same altitude, same location. I think the docking used to be like a 2 or 3 day procedure. And they've recently made some changes so that the docking can take place something like within a fraction of a day of the first take, of the same takeoff day. Isn't that approximately true? This sounds like a very fast link up. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, you're right. Going back decades, with the Mir spacecraft and now with the International Space Station, it always took sometimes almost 3 days to get to the International Space Station. But they got so good at it, and over the last couple of years, they actually started with the Progress cargo ships from Russia, and they started with them, and they got up there in 6 hours. And, like today, it's 5 hours and 45 minutes, I think they said. So, and it helps because they can actually take more cargo up or more fuel. So, gonna have even more stuff for the astronauts, or you can have more fuel for the space station too eventually. Put it to a higher orbit. So, very beneficial. And it's a lot better for the astronauts to go for a 6-hour ride instead of a 2 or 3 hour ride. What they do is they wait for the space station just to come over overhead in Kazakhstan, and it's only a couple hundred miles off. Just passes the passes them, and that's when they launch, and it happens to work out that way, where they can get up there for 6 hours. So yeah, you heard right there. Okay, so let me continue on then. A couple of missions that are coming up in 2016 anyway, that we're going to have a flight, the InSight mission, they call it, the next unmanned spacecraft that will go to Mars. They're working on it now. Spacecraft has a, you know, when they're building it, they're going to build it similar to the Phoenix spacecraft that landed on the northern part of Mars a few years ago. And this one is going to be looking into the surface, what Mars is really like underneath. It's going to drill a couple of, maybe 6, 7, 8 feet into the ground. Got a seismometer on there, and it's really going to look into what this thing is made of. It's called the InSight mission. The name is Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigation, Geodesy, and Heat Transport. So, you know, I'm looking forward to it. It's over a year away, but, they're making some progress on it. It should land roughly equatorial. It's not going to be a northern or southern landing like Phoenix was. I'm worried about timing out. I know it's a little quick tonight. This WS to West. Okay, I want to go on to what SpaceX is doing. I know they have a flight coming up in December, the fifth cargo flight to the International Space Station. But right now they're also building or rebuilding 39A down in Florida. They're getting this complex ready for a first for them. They plan on launching in maybe March or maybe between March or June. I'm going to go with June. The Falcon Heavy. Falcon Heavy consists of 3 Falcon 9 boosters or first stages bolted together. And then they have a stage on top of that. And this is a demonstration mission to see how they do with this thing. And big plans for it eventually. This is going to be their heavy lift vehicle to put things into geosynchronous orbit and eventually have these boosters, all 3 of them, come back and land on land. So they have big plans for it, and they have bought up this launch pad 39A that was used for Apollo. It was used for the space shuttle missions, a lot of the space shuttle missions, not all of them, including the last space shuttle mission. So you're going to have 3 Falcon 9s now. The reason they call it a Falcon 9 is because they have 9 engines, and each engine is called a Merlin engine. It's a Merlin 1D, so normally they have 9.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
2.5 minutes. The 2 boosters on the side will eventually separate. for the center one, and eventually that will separate and that will come back to land. And there's a stage on top of that to put the payload into orbit. And according to SpaceX, the amount of payload they could put into, let's say, a geosynchronous orbit would be, you know, 53 tons. So that would be twice the amount of what the biggest one that NASA has right now, which is the Delta IV Heavy. Delta IV Heavy can do about half of that. So it's a big improvement if this all works out. Delta IV Heavy is the one that's going up in December, and that's the one that's going to be taking the Orion spacecraft to 3,600 miles into space. It will do four orbits, roughly a 5-6 hour mission, and then it will come back at 20,000 miles per hour to test out its heat shield. So it'll test out the electronics, all the maneuvering capability, the heat shield. It will test out the escape mechanism built by Orbital Science. And basically the whole Orion payload will be about 80 feet tall. It's got the service module, the Orion spacecraft, and the escape tower attached to it. And all to be launched by the Delta IV Heavy. So that's similar to the Falcon 9 idea. It's three of them, three main boosters, three Delta IVs. Delta IVs bolted together to combine one rocket. So that should be pretty good. The other mission that we talked about a couple of months ago is the SMAP, the Soil Moisture Mapping Mission. We talked about that. That's the one with the 29-foot diameter antenna that's going to be spinning around at 14 revolutions per minute, attached to a spacecraft, taking measurements over land, getting the same reading from the same spot every 2 or 3 days. It's a radar mapping mission, but I'm fascinated by that mission, because that's going to be some mechanical contraption spinning around in orbit, actually on a polar orbit that will be launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base, and that's actually coming up. That'll be the end of January. Was the 29th, or so, the last time I looked forward to that launch. And a couple of other missions, another year, actually 2 years away, 2016, will be OSIRIS-REx mission. That's the asteroid mission. That will go out to an asteroid and eventually pick up material from it and bring it back. The asteroid is called Bennu. It'll stay out there for many months on end. But that won't launch until 2016. Probably won't get there until 2020. It'll investigate the asteroid for probably a half a year, and at the end, they have added another spacecraft to that OSIRIS-REx called ISIS. And that's going to have a big, heavy weight on it, similar to the Impact mission that they had years ago. They'll launch that from the OSIRIS-REx, let it slam into the asteroid, and so OSIRIS-REx is floating above the surface. That'll take the images and pictures. They'll look to see what's buried inside this asteroid. That's a very good mission once they get that off the ground. That'll be in September of 2016. It's also going to investigate something called the Yarkovsky effect. that has to do with heating and cooling of these asteroids. When they heat up, cool, the effect of that asteroid is momentum. As it cools, the photons and everything coming off the asteroid actually has a moving effect to it that affects the relatively small asteroids similar to this one. This is not a big asteroid. I think it's only about 1,500 meters or something in diameter. So they'd like to look at that because as different asteroids like this one gets heated and cooled, it changes its orbit. And as right now, anyway, they think it's like a 1 in 1,000 chance that it would hit the Earth in around 200 years from now. So they want to keep their eye on it, I guess, or at least investigate and see how it works out. Let me drop it. There's so many missions that are planned, but another one coming up this March is the MMS, the Magnus Spheric Multiscale Mission. And that's one that deals with magnetic reconnection. You might have read about this topic before, Dick, but magnetic reconnection is what happens in space around any big body like the sun or even the Earth, and when the magnetic lines get interfered with by other magnetic forces, sometimes they'll disconnect and then they'll reconnect. When they reconnect, if there's any particles or ions in the trail of the magnetic pieces that reconnect, they get liberated and they'll take off and sometimes at the speed of light. And what this spacecraft is four spacecraft built in series on top of one another. And it's going to be launched by Atlas V this March. To a very high elliptical orbit, something around 4,000 miles by apogee would be about 10 times that amount, 4,500 miles. And this way they can investigate the two spots, the one spot that has this effect, this magnetic recoupling type of event happens on the front side of the Earth where the sun hits the Earth, and that's relatively low, around 4,000 miles above the Earth. And then there's another spot behind the Earth that this reconnection occurs, and that's about 10 times that height, around 40,000 miles up. So these four spacecraft will be launched together, and then they'll separate. And what they'll do is they'll form a, they call it a pyramid, but it's really a tetrahedron. And this way they'll take measurements of this recoupling event, hopefully they'll be in the right spot at the right time when it occurs, and they'd like to see what this is all about. And so, we'll see the science behind that. One other little topic. The company Blue Origin is still working now with NASA. They just signed up with them to continue getting support from NASA. Not financial support, but technical support. Because they are presently building a BE-3 rocket for their use and eventually used for NASA. And they're also working and have been working on another rocket, the BE-4, for the last 3 years that they just signed up with Boeing to construct a rocket which will eventually replace some of the Russian rockets that have been been used on the, are being used on the Atlas V rockets. So that's pretty much it, Dick. I don't want to hold it too much longer, but, you know, there's always more. There's no end to this. You know, in fact, there's, let me drop it. There's so many flights, and I try to cover the worldwide flights, you know, ones from Russia, the ones from India, China, and worldwide, I counted them up, there's 15, just 15 flights left until the end of this year, so in a little over a month, there's still another 15 flights. Impossible to cover them all, but I try to pick out the ones with that are either most interesting, I think they're interesting, or have a lot of science behind it, Dick. But we can't cover all of these. There's some flights going off from China and India, and I'm not going to be able to cover it. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, this is WS2N, space portion of the TechNet, and the email here, by the way, is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to you, Dick.
So you sent an email to spacenetreport@gmail.com. You're talking to Paul, and you can ask him his your particular questions. Fascinating material, Paul. At least two areas I'd like to have a couple more conversations on. The Orion is going to have four orbits at 3,600 miles. That's really up there. A typical space shuttle orbit is something like 180 miles. I think the International Space Station is something like 240 miles altitude above the surface. So you multiply these by 15, 3,600 miles is really out there. I think you're way beyond the inner Van Allen belt. I think you're heavily into the outer Van Allen belt. And so to dwell there for four orbits with astronauts on board, they're being cooked a little bit. I wonder if the Van Allen belt radiation that they're going to be going through and dwelling in, I wonder if that was mentioned at all and what you read about that Orion 4 orbit mission and then re-enter at 20,000 miles to test the heat shield. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
They're going to have all kinds of sensors on board to evaluate the Van Allen belt, of course. Yes, I did read that. Of course, there's not going to be anybody on board. It's unmanned. This is their first test mission. And even if they planned on manning it, they wouldn't be allowed to launch it on the Delta IV Heavy. The rockets, the R-68 rockets that they use on the Delta IV, they're not man-rated. They're not like the RS-25s that were put on the space shuttle. Although they both operate with liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, the complexity is much simplified for the Delta IV, and they're expendable. And with the RS-25 for the shuttle were reusable. And a lot of the other components, they did not build the Delta IV to be man-rated. So it's not good for human services. if they were going to do that, then they would have to do a complete all-up run, you know, they'd have to actually wait until the SLS was built, the Space Launch System. So that will actually be the next test quite a few years from now. When that is completed, they'll put the Orion on top of it, and that will probably also be unmanned, and they'll fly that out to the moon and back, and they'll run some tests, similar tests. Back to you, Dick.
My memory is that Mercury, Apollo, and Gemini, at the period of launch, had this escape tower mechanism mounted to the top of the human-inhabited space capsule, which gets jettisoned later on, but I think that escape tower had the ability where if something was going wrong with the booster, it's starting to go into the explosion mode or steer off to some crazy direction, you would blow some explosive bolts, the space capsule would be disconnected from the rest of the vehicle, the escape tower with its three rockets above you blasting off to the side, at an angle to make sure that the flame doesn't come down to the space capsule. They lift the space capsule up and away at some altitude, and then a parachute deploys, and that's the escape mechanism for the astronauts of those three older programs. Does the Orion, first of all, I'm very glad to hear that it's unmanned at 3,600 miles for four orbits. That explains the Van Allen radiation belt human exposure problem, but does Orion have a somewhat similar escape mechanism, Paul, when a pilot's on board, when pilots are on board, when men are on board, if anything goes wrong, let me drop this. If anything goes wrong with the booster, it'd be nice to know there's a way you can get away from the smoke and flames, if you know what I mean. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, a couple of things. The Orion spacecraft that they're using, when it comes back, they're going to refurbish it, fix it up a little bit. And they plan on using that for the next future test on the SLS, you know, some years from now. So that's not, you know, they don't have to build a new one for that. The escape mechanisms that are used, well, you can see it on the Soyuz rocket today that went up. That has a similar setup on top of the spacecraft. You have this tractor pulling system. And in the case of the SLS, the Space Launch System that they're building, which is going to be more powerful than the Saturn V setup, that has on top the tractor pulling mechanism as well. Four rockets that would pull the whole spacecraft away from the booster in case it, you know, of an emergency. And then after it pulls it away, that also separates. That has other rockets that will separate it from the spacecraft itself. The spacecraft itself would then float down and deploy its parachutes. And that's how that whole setup is made. It's called a tractor setup. Other companies, SpaceX using the man-rated Dragon version 2, they call it V2, and also the new company I was telling you about that's now finally getting into the news, although they've been around for a while, is Blue Origin. Blue Origin is developing their own spacecraft eventually, and their own rocket. And they plan on having a reusable rocket and come back and land in a similar fashion that SpaceX is doing, come back vertically on land. The system that both companies use, as well as Boeing, is called the pusher system. They have rockets built into the side of the spacecraft. And if something happens, these things light off and push the whole spacecraft away from the rocket. And I've seen some tests on it. It really works quite well. And again, the parachutes pop open. But it actually pushes the spacecraft away. SpaceX, they have eight of these rockets surrounding the man-rated Dragon spacecraft. They're not on the cargo, but they'll be on the man-rated one. And these pusher rockets, each one has 16,000 pounds per square inch. So you add that up, you know, times eight, you have plenty of power to push the spacecraft away from the booster in case of an emergency, you also have enough power that after your spacecraft is finishing docking with the International Space Station or with the Bigelow Space Station and decides to come back, it doesn't have to come back the same way that Orion's coming back or that any of these spacecraft have come back, including the Soyuz. They plan on coming through the atmosphere and using propulsive energy from these same rockets that would normally be used to save the spacecraft in case of an emergency. These things are going to fly it all the way down to the Earth without any parachutes. That's the ultimate goal. So you have that type. So you have pusher types and the tractor type. Interesting. I know we mentioned this before in the past. And if you look at all the old pictures from Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, the big difference when you look at them, Mercury and Apollo had the tractor system. Pull it away, no problem. Take a look at the launch setup that Gemini had using the Titan rockets. There was no tractor pulling system. So two of the most dangerous spacecraft I think that we ever sent up with people in it are Gemini and, of course, the Space Shuttle. Space Shuttle had no way of saving itself from a booster. For earliest flights, you could tell, if you look at the top of the shuttle, the earliest Space Shuttle flights, they did have ejection seats built into the Space Shuttle. But they did away with them because they found out that the Space Shuttle was safe. Back to you, Dick, WS2S.
And except for the Challenger accident and the Columbia accident, yes, it was safe. But I guess no one guaranteed that space was going to be safe. We knew that it was relatively high-risk occupation. I think the space shuttle had a total of, I'm going to make a guess, of 165 launches. And out of 165 launches, we had two failures. Those are my quick guess at the numbers. Am I anywhere close, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I would have liked to have seen it go a little longer, up to 165. That would have been good. Now, 135 was the number, the 135.
Okay, two failures out of 135. Yes, I guess a 1.5% failure rate, rough number. And considering the complexity of that vehicle, had umpteen million individual components that all had to work correctly or you get into a heap of trouble, maybe it's about the best you could expect. Although, with hindsight, we know that that chunk of foam that was breaking off from the external tank, coming down and hitting the wing, and that happened a number of times. Only on Columbia did it hit hard enough with a big enough chunk of ice that it penetrated the leading edge. And after that, it was game over, so to speak. That happened on launch. And you could say that they didn't truly discover it until re-entry. What could have been done in between, had they known about that error, is an interesting question. As I remember, one of the key cameras on launch was not working, so they didn't have a clear picture whether or not that strike created damage to the leading edge on launch. Let me drop. And there are some people who thought that there were various optical resources on Earth and maybe even the Hubble Space Telescope could have, in theory, be aimed at the space shuttle. Take a good close-up picture and see whether or not any damage occurred from that chunk of ice. I guess I wish they had put heaters in the area of that chunk of ice to stop the ice from forming. It's very similar to what happened when a vendor who misunderstood what his contract was to apply birds to a jet engine that was on a test stand to measure whether or not the engine had survivability. And I guess the vendor didn't like the idea of taking a live bird and throwing it into an engine of a commercial airliner. So he took a frozen bird, and of course the engine ground up immediately. A chunk of ice that's called bird is an entirely different object, because when you freeze water, it becomes an entirely different substance compared to liquid water. As you probably know, there was a couple of teenagers a few years ago who went and bought a frozen turkey from a supermarket on Long Island, and then they went riding in their automobile, and as a joke, somebody threw the frozen turkey out the window, and it struck the windshield of another automobile coming toward them and did a lot of damage to the vehicle, the windshield, and the driver. I think the driver was heavily damaged in that incident. Let me drop it.
Menton, 1YDY.
YDY, go ahead.
Once upon a time, I used to work for the Grumman Corporation, and the story you told of the vendor with the frozen birds reminds me very much of a story that was circulated amongst the older engineers at Grumman, where they talked about the same type of miscommunication when they were trying to do canopy bird strike tests, and they were supposed to shoot a bird at the front windshield of the prototype of the F-14. Development after the TFX problem, and before they actually called it the F-14, and I can't remember the name of the model while it was still developmental. But anyway, the vendor used a frozen bird instead of a live one, so it didn't give them the examination, or I'm sorry, the result they expected.
Yeah, I can see that, Mike. A very different response. That's William. Sorry about that. When you put ice in a microwave oven, the microwave oven behaves extremely differently than it does with water. With ice in a microwave oven, the microwave oven almost thinks it is empty.
That's Hank Dick.
Okay. William H. So therefore he calls himself Hank. Okay. Sorry about that. Water is a bipolar molecule, but you force that bipolar molecule to be in a matrix called ice, where it can no longer rotate. It can vibrate in spot, but it can no longer rotate. And so your huge loss tangent. Loss tangent is the fancy mathematical term used for rating the rate at which RF energy gets absorbed by a substance. Teflon, for instance, is a material with about the lowest loss tangent you can get. Teflon is a very ideal radio material. Water is about the lossiest stuff you can get, but ice is somewhere in between the two. Let me drop. So ice mechanically is very different, electronically is very different, and look out for it. And so we're approaching the winter time where we're going to be considering it. As you guys have heard me say, when you drive down a long, steep, icy hill, you will put your vehicle in neutral and pump the brakes. You will not leave it in gear on a long, descending, icy hill. As I said before, the people in the rural area know that. The people in the metro area do not know that. And the people who teach the defensive driving course do not know that. I spent quite a bit of time at the Romare Development Center near Utica, New York. And their test site on top of a mountain was a long, descending, icy road. And occasionally, one of those military vehicles would go down that road, and the person, out of force of habit, would put the vehicle in low to go down the hill. And pretty soon, his drive wheels were not keeping up with the road, with the rotation of the road, therefore the steering disappears. Therefore, he would end up in the gully on the side of the road, and a great big crane would have to come along to remove the vehicle. And I saw that happen on the day that I went down on a very icy day. And on top of that mountain with the ice on the parking lot, I now know why all of those vehicles that those guys drive had studded tires. I had none set of tires on my station wagon, my Oldsmobile station wagon. Let me drop it. The wind and the ice on top of that mountain, my Oldsmobile station wagon was being driven by the wind. I'm looking out the window and watching my car slide and move, even though the emergency brake was set. And it was in drive, it was in park. Let me drop it. And I was watching my vehicle.